Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail.
Welcome to this edition of the Retail Focus Podcast. I'm Trent Kling. Glad you could join us here today for Leighton Working Behind the Scenes. And today's episode features a couple of different stories. Later on in the show, we'll look ahead to Bed Bath & Beyond's earnings call coming up next week. Our interview guest is Sarah Fisher. She's the owner of Nature's Pantry Farm in Minnesota, and we'll talk to her about retailing direct to the consumer from the farm, how you handle the vertically integrated supply chain that you're likely to see from farm to consumer retailers, and other facets of retailing off a farm. Very interesting interview and an area of retail, let's face it, oftentimes ignored. We're not ignoring it today. We're putting it in center stage. But first, we'll discuss Costco's earnings, which took center stage this last week on Thursday, September 24th. A quick reminder that you can like us and rate us however you access us, whether that be through Amazon Podcasts or Amazon Music. We're on there, of course, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, any other podcast listening platform. You can also check us out social media at Retail Podcast on both Twitter and Instagram. I do note that the number of Twitter bots following us is ramping up. We had 30 to 40 bots follow us, a couple of actual followers, of course. Just in the last couple of days, Leighton joked with me that they must be ramping up prior to the election. Now let's talk Costco. Again, earnings this week. Stock market-centered headlines noted increasing sales, but some Wall Street negativity as Costco saw increased expenditures in staffing. We're not terribly concerned about the stock price in comparison to actual performance. That's not something we mention a whole lot, especially recently. But when you look at Costco shares, they finished Friday down a little over 1% from Thursday's close. Keep in mind the earnings call took place Thursday evening, and this on a trading day in this last Friday where the major indices were up over 1%. Still, based on these headlines, you would have thought that Wall Street disliked the quarter even more than was the case. And oftentimes you see headlines designed to maybe make you click through to them a little bit. But in reality, Costco's quarter was reasonably good as compared to expectations, even heightened Wall Street expectations. And for them, pandemic buying conditions have actually resulted in sales increases that have maybe lagged behind some other general merchandise retailers or been right in line with others. That's exactly what we saw this quarter. And of course, they update things month on month, so nothing really caught us by surprise necessarily. But you remember back to March and April, Costco was one of the first to set major restrictions on the number of shoppers in the store. In fact, early to mid-March, you saw those restrictions go into place at a lot of Costco locations where companies like Walmart and Target weren't yet beginning to throttle numbers that were in the store. And it appeared to have a resulting restrictive effect on their market share in comparison to others, where you saw other businesses absolutely booming. Costco's were throttled a little bit. Looks like this quarter was more of the same. Good increases in comp sales, but increases that weren't too much greater than comps Costco had a few years ago in just regular consumer conditions. Now, as I mentioned, Costco releases these sales figures on a monthly basis, so nothing here comes as too much of a surprise when we talk about the numbers to those retail onlookers that are looking at Costco sales on a month-by-month basis. Their comp store sales, if you just look at the raw numbers, you would see 11% increases in the U.S. and 11.4% throughout the entire company when you take into account non-domestic locations. But excluding fuel deflation and a few other effects, comps in the U.S. came in about 13.6% up over last year. So that's really the number that we're looking at. Certainly pretty impressive for them, but right in that band that you're seeing with general merchandise and club retailers throughout the country. Increases in e-commerce sales in this band for general merchandise and wholesale club retailers varied greatly across the retail board. But for Costco in this quarter, they had comps come in at 90.6% growth. E-commerce only, that is. That's roughly in the spectrum of what we've mostly seen. We've seen anywhere between the 30s to into the hundreds. So Costco kind of right in the middle of that spectrum. When you look at other warehouse clubs, Costco came in above Sam's, which was 39% during the most recent quarter. BJ's, by the way, whose online presence is approximately in the same maturity stage as Costco, both companies, analysts and onlookers have said, need to get on the e-commerce bandwagon a little bit quicker. They saw over 300% digital sales growth. So again, in between those numbers, certainly for Costco. And it's worth noting that Sam's overall comps for the most recent quarter were up 13.3%. BJ's up 24.2%. We actually talked on the show about their excellent quarter. So you could make an argument that Costco's market share has been maybe endangered somewhat. If nothing else, it's just holding flat over their fellow warehouse clubs over the last 5 to 6 months. Increasingly, though, traffic for Costco was up in this fourth quarter over their last year's fourth quarter by 1.2% in the U.S. That bucks the trend of some retailers who are actually seeing cuts in traffic due to increased basket size and customers making fewer trips. So we did think that was a little bit interesting, the fact that people coming through the doors, that number is actually higher. Now, overall sales were up 12.5% for Costco during the quarter. That's including that fuel deflation and all of that. That's not adjusted for fuel deflation. Earnings per share coming in at $3.13 per diluted share. This compares with $2.47 per diluted share last year. On the whole, they saw COVID-related expenses come in at $281 million. And again, that's what led a lot of the stock-centric headlines. That's inclusive of sanitation and wage premium costs. Costco has been, throughout the course of this pandemic, paying their workers a premium over what is, for Costco, already a very good wage, in most cases $15 an hour or higher. But as we noted, because they give sales updates monthly, none of this stuff was really an outlier compared to what was expected. We were primarily just interested in this quarterly call to get more information on their sales figures and some of their initiatives for the upcoming fiscal year, and more importantly, for the next couple of months. One of the numbers we look at consistently for Costco is membership. After adjustments to their record keeping, they saw growth of 1.0 million households sequentially over the third quarter in total paid households, so total paid household memberships. Perhaps bigger from a monetary standpoint, they were able to increase the number of executive memberships sequentially over the third quarter by about 765,000 memberships. So again, executive memberships, they're top of the line memberships. That's something they've really been pushing over the last couple of years, trying to convert those memberships that are maybe lower level memberships to that executive level. They ended up seeing a 3.5% sequential increase in executive members, which again is more money coming in towards the bottom line. And membership flow for Costco, whether it be executive or otherwise, continues to be substantially positive. They continue to bring in more money via memberships, even in a time where some are said to be curtailing household spending. So a good sign for Costco that many households are seeing a Costco membership as something they absolutely have to have. And you're seeing other people even jump aboard the Costco bandwagon in terms of those memberships. Now, in other areas for Costco, we've known for a while that sales of fresh goods and consumables have been strong since March, and they've been a big factor in those comp sales jumps for Costco. However, CFO Richard Galanti, who is, by the way, the only company rep on the call for Costco, made a point that increasing sales in their fresh category — fresh is basically a category under the auspices of their core category, so again, you're talking about a lot of fresh produce, goods that are sold fresh, basically, not frozen, canned, or anything like that — that was a major driver of gross margin for them as well. And you don't often hear these types of categories called out for a margin boost, but it was a common sense factor at play here. Galanti reported that the margin boost from fresh came in from lower D&D, or what they call damaged and destroyed produce. So less product spoilage in this category, mainly coming from the fact that they moved product more quickly. So you think about the typical produce section. If product isn't moving, you've got a lot more markdowns there. You've got produce that you're throwing away because it's going bad. Because they were bringing in higher traffic, and because this traffic was going increasingly towards the produce section, they were able to capitalize on this and actually drive margins up for this area of the store, just because they weren't throwing as much away or discounting as much. He also mentioned that they saw efficiency gains in labor productivity in this department as well. Essentially, they were able to leverage their current staff to support higher sales levels. The staff that they already had could support sales levels that they were seeing prior to the pandemic, but the increases in sales during the pandemic did not cause them to have to increase produce department staffing, or fresh department staffing in this case. So their current hiring levels were enough to accommodate the increase in those fresh sales. All of this led to a 70 basis point positive impact on margins in their core merchandise categories. They also talked on the call about their supply chain. One of the reasons is because they have wanted to continue expansion of stores in the U.S. So stores called for them warehouses. They had to put a couple of openings off for this fiscal year. Not necessarily as bad as other retailers because they're still opening them up. They want to open them early on in now the new fiscal year for them as they just finished off the fourth quarter. But they want to open up 20 net new warehouses or stores in this coming year. This is after a net increase of 13 this past year. And they also want to relocate three other warehouses. So you're looking at a big increase for them. One of their largest years in terms of store count increase or warehouse count increase over the last several years. Very positive sign for them. And to that point, whenever you add more stores to your system, whenever you add more of these warehouses to your system, you've got to source goods to stock those warehouses. Sourcing goods was a major part of the earnings call. As we talked about, supply chain took up a lot of the prepared statements for Galanti on the earnings call. And as far as sourcing goods is concerned, there was important insight on their imports from China. Galanti noted that most of the factories in China seem to be up and running, and there are few current disruptions in sourcing product from China at this point. Now, there are existing downstream challenges that were noted currently in electronics, computers, and certain white goods. So you think of bedding and the like. Other areas, though, looking pretty good. He noted that PPE supply, for example, that's strong currently. Masks are moving out. They're able to get them in just as fast as they move out. Paper product restrictions are lifting for them. Milk, butter, seafood, all kinds of proteins, all in good shape as well. One of the other challenge areas, though, for them includes sanitizing wipes and latex gloves, having a hard time keeping those in stock. But you look overall in terms of the supply chain for Costco, very positive news coming out of this earnings call. And we heard so much, even as recently as a month ago, about some chinks in the protein supply chains throughout the country. Well, Costco's saying, hey, we're having no problem getting proteins, getting seafood, getting milk and butter and dairy into our stores. So that's a really good sign, not only for Costco, but certainly the rest of the industry that either dabbles in general merchandise or grocery. Finally, one of the more intriguing things discussed on the call was their Halloween assortment. We mentioned on the show a few weeks ago that Five Below leadership was seeing a movement away from costumes and such, and a movement towards Halloween decor as a potential replacement good. Galanti said on this call that indeed they did plan a small reduction in costumes they will carry during the season. When he was pressed about this reduction during the analyst Q&A, he specified that costume inventory is about 80 to 90% of what they would typically carry, with that number closer maybe to 80%. Part of this is a supply chain issue. Part of this is based on a shortage of costumes from certain overseas vendors. So they've had to scramble to find some additional vendors to satisfy demand. But part of it is they just don't anticipate the demand being there for costumes as a whole. He noted Costco's desire to go a little bit more basic. So rather than seeing decor as a substitute good, they see things like candy, they see things like cheaper household items that are going to replace those particular costume categories for Costco. And they're reacting to it by carrying fewer costumes, of course, in store, really trying to ramp up the amount of candy they are carrying in store. And they indicated that not only is this a Halloween phenomenon, but it's also a likely path for Christmas-related merchandise as well. So we're not talking about necessarily seasonal in terms of gifts, but we're talking about Christmas and other seasonal-related products that are sold specifically for that season. They want to focus more on what they called, again, basic items, smaller household items that would have extended use rather than larger seasonal products. So you might not see as many of those blow up Christmas trees there for the front yard at Costco during the next quarter. Now, Galanti was also asked during the Q&A on the call as to whether they've seen any differences versus years past in terms of consumer spending, regional or otherwise. This particular analyst said, hey, we're seeing virus spikes in certain areas. Are you seeing those areas pull back? Galanti didn't really answer the question directly necessarily, but did note that based on the sales they're seeing in seasonal so far, the states that opened up more quickly saw earlier sales of Halloween merchandise. Otherwise, they haven't noticed any dramatic shifts in seasonal buying habits. But I thought this was interesting because you look at this phrase and said basically, hey, the states that opened up more quickly, that's been a domino effect. People have been more likely in those states to jump into seasonal merchandise purchasing than they have been in other areas. And I think that's a very interesting thing to keep in mind because you might see some of that regionality start to play into some of the recovery indices and some of the numbers that we're seeing. We talked, of course, to Danny Cushion of Cardlytics a few weeks ago about their state-by-state index. You could see a ripple effect. The states that opened up earlier might still be seeing increased sales from that earlier opening back in May and June and July versus states that more or less stayed closed, like, for example, California. So ultimately, a lot of different dynamics at play for seasonal for Costco, but they reiterated something that we've been hearing, which is that costumes might not be that big of a deal this year. They're having to switch to other goods. For Five Below, it's decor. For Costco, it's more basic and candy. Interesting to see what other retailers have to say about this as earnings season or as the next earnings season progresses. Well, that'll do it for the news portion of the show. Coming up after this break, we'll talk with Sarah Fisher, the owner of Nature's Pantry. And as I mentioned at the top of the show, direct sales from farms to consumers are often ignored in the retail space, but there's a lot that goes into it, specifically as the supply chain and planning is concerned. And there's a lot of different aspects to this retail than meet the eye. We'll talk to Sarah about some of those specifics right after this. No matter where you live, you've probably seen a farmer's market or roadside farm stand. They are pretty prolific across the U.S., yet when it comes to the world of retail coverage, most look past them to cover chain retailers. But to put it in perspective, if you remember all the headlines about New York and Company's bankruptcy back in July, they were everywhere across the retail news circuit. But sales at farmers markets and direct from the farms each year accounts for several times, nearly 20 times the revenue in a single year of New York and Company. And so we're giving farms their due here on the podcast today. And here to talk about the unique nature of selling straight from the farm to the consumer is Sarah Fisher, the owner of Nature's Pantry Farm in Minnesota. Nature's Pantry retails grass-fed beef, pastured pork and chicken, free-range eggs, honey, and more to customers all throughout southern Minnesota. Sarah, thank you so much for joining us today on the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me, Trent.
So first, I was wondering if you could give a little bit of a background on the farm, because the backstory, I think, is interesting, kind of how the operation came about and then what the farm looks like today.
Sure. Yeah, so our family farm is a six-generation farm. We're in South Central Minnesota. We have 300 acres. When I grew up here, we had a conventional dairy. So 60-cow dairy is what we had. We did everything conventional, everything by the book, never questioned a thing. And we did this all growing up, and then the time came for my siblings and myself to start going off to college and leaving. And we knew that the farm was not a good fit for any of us. We saw the financial hardship operating a dairy has and just all of the work. So we knew that we wanted something more for us. So we all left, and this left a ton of work for my mom and dad. And during this time, my dad ended up hurting his knee and had surgery. It was supposed to be on crutches for 6 weeks. And you can imagine how well that went, operating a dairy on crutches. So they made the hard decision to sell the cows. And just like so many small family farms in America, like that was going to be the end of our farm. So it was a really hard time for them. But looking back now, it was by far the biggest blessing that has ever happened to us, because he finally had some free time. And he asked one very simple question. And that question was, why is everyone so sick? So he wanted to get to the bottom of that question. He spent months and months researching, and he came to the conclusion that a large part of why we're seeing so much illness is from the way that we are farming and producing our food. So then at the same time, my husband and I were having our first child, and I was just horrified learning all of this stuff. And GMOs are a perfect example of, you know, the World Health Organization has classified them as a probable carcinogen to humans. Well, as a mother, I can't know that and feed that to my child. So what started out as truly just wanting to raise food for our own family has evolved to Nature's Pantry. And now we're supporting about 150 families off of our farm. And we direct market everything from our farm straight to the consumer.
So everything now is direct to the consumer, whereas before in the conventional farm, I'm guessing it was going to milk co-ops and that type of thing. And I think the USDA ran an interesting survey, I think it was back in 2018, that said direct-to-consumer farms are apt to have less financial hardship than those maybe that are selling to, you know, co-ops or going the traditional route. What made you decide when you were like, hey, let's go ahead and I know we're growing this for ourselves, but let's market this to the rest of the world. What made you decide to use that direct-to-consumer approach instead of a more traditional approach in terms of marketing what the farm was producing?
Well, growing up, like I said, we saw the financial hardship. You are reliant on the markets. One day you can make a decent living. The next week your paycheck is cut in half. So we knew like that was never going to work. My parents did that for 35 years. But honestly, we never like had this sit down meeting. We're going to direct market all of our products and this and that. Honestly, it kind of started by accident. Our business just built by word of mouth. And then we sort of got to the point where we had enough family supporting us on a regular basis, probably about 4 years into what we were doing, that we realized that we could be successful. We can set our own prices. Like, this is what we need to make a profit, and this is what we need to be successful. And then I came across Charlotte Smith course from her 3-Cal Marketing business, Farm Marketing from the Heart. And that taught me so much about marketing, how to build a loyal, supportive customer base, and how to build a profitable farm while doing it. So that played a huge role in what we're doing. And from there, it just exploded.
So of course, you've got several families that got connected with you early on in the process, but there's a lot of ways that farms can kind of leverage the direct-to-consumer approach to reach customers. You know, we talked about farmers markets in the beginning, but obviously, you've got a number of different options there, whether it's meeting the families at a certain meeting location. What are some of the things that your farm has tried, and what are some of the things that you found most successful as far as reaching that customer?
Sure. So we do have a few different options for our families at this point. The first thing that we started with was an on-site farm store. So that is stocked with our raw milk, eggs, yogurt, buttermilk, and we've got grass-fed beef in there as well. We've also got some local organic apples from a local farmer. So everybody that comes gets just a quick orientation. And then from there on, it is a self-serve on the honor system. And that works really great. Secondly, we have 4 drop locations in the metro, which is about an hour and a half from where we're located. 3 of these locations are in people's homes. And then 1 is in the health center. And we make deliveries every 10 to 14 days. So we've got, you know, our core group of families that order every week and a half or so from us, and then they come and pick it up from those families. And then finally, we just launched our shipping program, which is via GrazeCart, and now we're able to ship our grass-fed beef, and we'll have pastured pork coming soon to most of Minnesota and a few areas in the surrounding states.
So let's talk about that aspect of it, because you mentioned you're using, in this case, it's a company called GrazeCart to help them market that online. Everyone is talking about, in the chain retail world, e-commerce and how important that is. What were some of the steps and what were some of the procedures in terms of setting up that online account? And what were some of the things that you had to focus on as you were creating that online presence?
We switched to GrazeCart probably about a year ago. Prior to that, we really did it because we wanted to start offering USDA inspected meat like by the package. Prior to that, we were just offering wholesale, like quarters of beef, half of hogs. And then we used Squarespace for that. And that was totally fine and user-friendly for what we were doing. But now, like, just getting down to the nitty-gritty, like, GraceCart is just a really easy-to-use, farm-oriented program. And it's super streamlined the process for the customers. So, like, we can't recommend GraceCart enough for anybody who is in the meat sales or anything like that.
So you mentioned it, you wanted to sell the USDA certified beef, which brings me to the USDA and the whole certification program. Obviously, on a farm, it's a lot different than just, say, a grocery store. There's, you know, some bureaucracy that you have to go through. What are some things, without getting, you know, too into the minutiae of it, what are some things and considerations that you have to keep in mind selling either direct to the public or online in terms of making sure that you're good as far as the USDA is concerned?
So one of our biggest struggles right now is the lack of butcher dates that are available. Since COVID has hit, the butcher shops have been inundated with animals for processing. And that really created a challenge with our USDA beef. We were out of beef for probably 4 to 6 weeks, and there was nothing they could do to get us in any sooner. You know, we didn't have product available, so that creates an opportunity for your customers to go find it somewhere else. And maybe it's a little more convenient, or maybe it's a little more affordable, or whatever it may be. So as a small scale producer, that has been really challenging for us. And actually, just a few weeks ago, I had to set our butcher dates for next summer and fall, and we're not even done butchering for this year yet, because we just can't be caught without having a butcher date for all of our animals and our families that are relying on that meat every year.
So that's certainly an aspect of it that I'm sure a lot of people on the outside looking in don't realize, is that things like that have to be set so far in advance. What other things would you inform the public about, just in terms of, you know, if I don't know anything about running a farm, I just go and pick up eggs, let's say, at your farm or what have you. What's one thing or a few different things you might want to educate people on, just that they might not know about that entire farm process?
So I think COVID has really done a great job of opening people's eyes of the importance of supporting a local food system. Yeah, it just might be eggs to you, but truly that could make or break for a local farm, that someone being able to stay home or support their family. And it really is an exciting time to be a farmer in my eyes. People want to know the story of their food and they want to know where it's coming from. And we've seen it. It's so obvious. We have this giant, frail food system that we've made. And now is like the perfect time to strengthen that local economy and strengthen that local farm.
One of the other things I wanted to touch on is just simply the level of communication that's required when you're selling direct to the public from a farm, because it's not like a grocery store where you just open up your doors and say, hey, we're open from this time to this time, and then the communication is essentially done outside of marketing and maybe social media and the like. For you, it's a lot different because families have to know when to pick up products, how to pick up products, what products are available to pick up. What's the communication like between you and your customers and some of the families that you service there?
So what we've recently switched to is using a Google survey for all of our drop locations up in the cities. And it's just a simple Google form. I list the delivery date at the top of the email and then what's available, the price, and then people just submit how many of each they would like. And then that formulates to me this wonderful spreadsheet, and I print it out, and then we just make the delivery. And they know to watch their email and to just watch for that form. The other thing, ordering online, like for quarters of beef, half a hogs, and things like that, that's all communicated via email. And starting an email list was really huge for us. So just to like keep that constant contact with your customers. So every couple of weeks, 2 to 3 weeks, I'll email our customers and just giving them like helpful things like how to cook a beef roast or how to cut up a chicken. I just show people how to make homemade butter. So people find value in these things, and it definitely drives loyalty to your farm.
So we're talking about, you know, driving loyalty, driving repeat business. We mentioned, obviously, with the butcher issues, maybe, you know, some chinks in the potential supply chain going forward. But what are some other things that you're doing to kind of develop your farm to make sure you're staying on top of what seems to be increasing demand over time for your product?
So a lot of that, we're sitting down I would say almost quarterly, and just figuring out, you know, what are our waiting lists? What do we need to have for next year? Obviously, setting butcher dates far in advance was something that we needed to do to make sure that we are able to offer this to our customers. We're in the process of transitioning we have some conventional land yet, but making those decisions and how can we use that land, turn it into regenerative farming and continue to grow our practice.
And it's not simply just something where you can say, well, we're seeing demand go up for, you know, the hogs. Let's just buy some more hogs and then we'll have, you know, more pork next week or what have you. So these decisions have to be made quite a bit in advance. Now, there's been some talk, and we've seen it, especially during COVID, I think it's been a bit accelerated, where there's a bit of a migration back to areas that maybe aren't quite as populated, people increasingly looking for land, want to make a go of smaller scale farming. What's the advice you would give to someone maybe looking to start their own farm in their own neck of the woods, not just in terms of the farming, but also reaching out to customers and maybe proliferating your customer base as well?
I would say absolutely start your own farm. I mean, I cannot find any greater satisfaction than being self-sufficient, but even more than that, being able to support and supply your local economy with food. So I just feel like the more of us, the better. The whole interest in local food is not going to be going away. There's too many people that are aware of the health benefits of locally, organically grown food, and together we can create a much more reliable, safer food system. And my belief is that we need to have our food system be in the hands of thousands of small farmers rather than a handful of just large farmers.
So one final question here, and it is just a little bit looking ahead, just in terms of getting product to the people. You know, we've talked about obviously focusing on the supply chain aspect, but are you in talks to, you know, try anything different outside of the pickup locations or the direct from farm sales? Are you pretty happy with where things are at there?
We're very happy with where things are at right now. And I would say each of our pickup locations is maxed out on what we can provide for. We couldn't provide for any more families at this point. My hope is with the shipping program that we've just launched that we will be able to increase our beef production and sell more beef by the cut and reach more families that way.
All right, fantastic insight. Once again, Sarah Fisher, the owner of Nature's Pantry Farm in Minnesota. Thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you so much, Trent.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
Well, we thank Sarah for joining us. And once again, if you are interested in Nature's Pantry, and as Sarah mentioned, you can really only get their products in Minnesota and some of the surrounding areas, but website is naturespantry-farm.com for them. Now, as far as looking ahead, October 1st is the scheduled day for Bed Bath & Beyond's next earnings call. The reason I feel like this is going to be an important earnings call is Bed Bath & Beyond was one of the retailers that was a little bit hesitant to open up many of their stores. They kept a lot of stores gray, so to speak, with just the buy online pickup in store fulfillment or just the buy appointment fulfillment. They've opened stores in other markets up, but there's a lot of other stuff going on at Bed Bath & Beyond. I think anytime we get a chance to see inside the head of Mark Tritton, the CEO, it's a positive thing. But moreover, it also represents an opportunity for analysts to ask some questions about their recently disclosed restructuring plan. Now, if you didn't catch news of this happened in late August. The company announced that part of the restructuring plan was cutting about 2,800 jobs across its corporate headquarters and, of course, its retail stores. They also mentioned maybe throwing out some new private label brands in 2021, talked about revamping the company's supply chain. Now, for me at least, this echoes a lot of what Bed Bath & Beyond was trying to do 3, 4, 5 years ago. So it seems as though just with a different leader in charge, they're trying to embark upon shaping the company to what Mark Tritton sees it as in the future. But that's not the only reason I want to look ahead to this earnings call is Tritton answering some of these questions. The other aspect of things is that Bed Bath & Beyond, when you look at expectations on Wall Street for them. Their share price has nearly tripled since March, which is very interesting. Right now, it's nearly at what it was prior to the pandemic hitting. And again, we've seen an increased mix in terms of e-commerce sales, whether that's buy online, pick up in store, whether that's direct fulfillment, whether that's curbside for them. That's another reason I want to look ahead to this. To what extent are customers using their e-commerce tools and this supposed revamp of their buy online, pick up in store platform at Bed Bath & Beyond? How much are their overall sales? How much have they been affected? Because again, some stores still haven't managed to reopen fully in certain markets. So you look at a lot of these things for Bed Bath & Beyond. This is a unique company and one that gives us certainly insight into not only some of the changes that they're trying to make to set themselves up for the next 10 years, but some of the changes they've had to make over the last 3.5 months. And that's why I'm looking ahead to this earnings call. You can bet that I will be listening in on October 1st. Now, there are some other interesting calls coming up this week, if so inclined. PepsiCo and Constellation Brands, among them, retail adjacent companies, of course. Constellation Brands, especially because you've seen an increase in purchase of alcohol and liquor. I would be anxious to see if they mention companies like Drizzly or delivery companies on their call. I think liquor especially is going to be the next big area. I hate the term disruption because everyone thinks they're a disruptor of everything. If that were the case, we wouldn't have anything left to disrupt. But I think the liquor retail industry is going to be the next one to see major changes in the next 2 to 3 years as state legislatures begin to wrap their head around alcohol delivery and kind of bring that portion of retail into the 21st century as well. So a few different things we're keeping an eye on for the week ahead. Next week's podcast, no midweek podcast this coming week, but next week's podcast is an exciting one. While I was driving through the Dakotas, I was able to visit in Bismarck, the Bisman Community Food Co-op, basically a food co-op selling a lot of natural and organic foods. It was phenomenal. I enjoyed my time there so much that I went there twice in maybe the 18 hours I was in Bismarck. So this coming week, we're going to talk to T. Jacob Smoody. He is the produce manager at the Bisman Community Food Co-op, and he leads up a lot of their multimedia efforts, a lot of their community outreach efforts. He's going to talk about the overall concept of the food co-op, how that's working to make sure that people in Bismarck have access to natural and organic food. But he's also going to talk about kind of cutting the middleman out of the supply chain. One of the most interesting things about this place is that literally a farmer can walk up to it with a bushel of eggplants or whatever and sell them to the food co-op, and then they're right on the shelves. So he'll talk about getting the farmers up to speed with wholesaling with grocery stores as well. Fantastic conversation with him, and I certainly hope you'll join us next week for that. It's always great to talk to someone. You know, as much as I love the technology side of things, it's always great to talk to someone that's on the ground floor, working directly with customers and the community, who is on the ground every single day in the retail universe. And that's one of the reasons why I love talking to people like T. Jacob Smoody. And when we talk to him next week, you'll find out he just has an absolute passion, not only for natural food and organics, but retail as well. So please join us next week for that. A big thanks to everyone behind the scenes for getting the podcast off the ground this week, including Leighton. And we'll be back 1 week from today.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.